This is the beginning of Class 7.
Sasi Bhurghi Jushin Neto Chan Vira Vinci Nyende Kempati Sange Shindu Mite Uwagi Jogunanda Shiva
division he makes. Nakule is black karma. And black karma is non-virtue. Where does, if you divide the world into the three realms, which are what? Yeah. Desire, form, and formless form. What's the desire realm? We're in the, no. Samsara covers all three realms. We're in the desire realm. And the first Dalai Lama says, because our main interests are food and sex. Okay. And that's why it's called desire. And then form realm and formless realm. How many of the six beings on the Wheel of Life Taka are in the desire realm? All six, okay. All six. All right, desire realm includes everything from hell, hungry ghosts, humans, demigods, and God. All those are in the desire realm. And then the last one, the what you call the gods, or I like to call it pleasure beings, they are also living in the formless realm. So you've only got one of the six types of beings existing in the two higher realms. And then in the lower realm, in the lowest of the three divisions, you have all six types of beings. And the people in the beings in the two higher realms cannot see. Your mind can go to that realm, and it has to go to that realm, for example, when you perceive emptiness directly, your mind has to be in the form. Those beings can't commit bad deeds. They don't commit bad deeds, mainly because they're in deep space of meditation. They also, like the formless realm beings, are just in a state of pretty much deep meditation. They don't commit bad deeds, per se. They have a lot of bad deeds left over from their last lives, and when they die, they usually go down to hell. Because they don't perform any new good deeds. Pleasure beings that have no bodies. They have, out of the five heaps, they only have four of the five heaps. They don't have any physical bodies. They're just Buddha. Yeah. Buddha's outside of all three realms, please. Okay? Although those three realms are suffering. One of them has all three kinds of suffering, and two of them only have anyway, so black karma is really referring to our realm. We're the ones who are good at collecting black karma. white karma. Oh, and the first Dalai Lama says, why do they call it white karma? I mean, black karma. He says, its essence is black and its result is black. Essence is black means that it has to do with mental. It doesn't mean it is a mental affliction, but it's in that, of the Four Noble Truths, it relates to the first two Noble Truths. It's either causing suffering or it is suffering. And then, that's the result is black because what? By definition, it's what? No. So the result, why is it called black karma? Because the result is black and the essence is black. The essence is tied up with samsara. And the result is suffering, unpleasant. Kartale is, kartal means what?
White.
White, okay, white karma. And they explain that as karma, virtuous karma in the former, not in our realm. Virtuous karma, the former, white karma. Why? Because the essence is, the result is white, obviously. What's the result?
Pleasure.
And, but then the essence is what? The essence is this. The person who has done this karma, in his mental continuum, he's full of suffering. He's not suffering, we're talking karma. He's not suffering outright. He has only the third kind of suffering. We talk about it a lot. Yeah, pervasive suffering means he has to get old and die. But he doesn't have outright suffering. They don't have any experiences of outright suffering. They don't normally go through it. They all have the accommodation. So they don't have the kind of gross suffering that we have. And then on the, then there's a third kind of karma. What do you think it is? Then there's a third kind of karma. What do you think it is? We call karna jepa. Say karna jepa. Karna jepa. Karna means what? White. Not means black. And jepa means mixed together. And that means, that refers to virtue in the desire realm. Its result is white or black. No, it's white. Virtue is always white. A good sensation. There's no difference between the result of what virtue collector in this realm and virtue collector in another realm. But the black part is different. Black means in this case, when you're talking about white and black karma mixed together, it refers to the being who's doing it. He's got suffering. He has suffering in his mind. So the person, if you look at it as a stream, the person who experiences the whiteness of the result and the person who did the deed and had suffering in him, it's black and white mixed. Our good karma, we can only do black. We can't do white karma.
Are you saying we can only do mixed karma?
Yeah, or black.
Or black.
There's a fourth choice, though.
All right.
On your homework, there might only be those three. Okay.
Yeah. Why is it impossible to do just virtue?
This is only in the former, because it refers to a person who's doesn't have outright suffering in his mental continuum, and he's also going, he's doing a good deed and he's going to experience a wide result. So this is how Sutra explains it. It's only one way of dividing it. There are dozens of ways of dividing it. It's just one that you might hear someday. Somebody says black karma, white karma. And it might sound like good deeds and bad deeds. It's not that. It refers to not only the result, which is obviously black or white, but to the nature of the person doing the deed. If he has some suffering, outright suffering in his being, then it's black and white mixed. Not referring to the result. So the blackness refers to the person causing it. He's got suffering in his mental. Well, yeah, he's got virtue, but if I haven't done it with these, but you're not coming. The whiteness here refers to the result. He did a good deed. We can do a good deed in this realm and it's going to have a good result. That's white. But the fact that the person doing the deed has suffering, his mental continuum is all suffering. Outright suffering. He's also black. He's also black. Does it produce a result which is black and white? In a way, because as long as you're still in samsara, even those pleasures, as you heard in the Friday night class, are really just more different forms of suffering. Sagme means sagme means unstained. Unstained. Not stained. And le means karma. He means that's just an adjective. Unstained karma. Alright? This is the kind of karma you do, according to Abhidharma, which doesn't have a white result or a black result. And in fact, its function is to remove the black karma. So these are in their school, like the direct perception of selflessness would be a sattva-gita. Okay. Some kind of pure karma that wipes out the bad karma.
There's nothing to do with neutral karma.
No. The fact is that it does not give a black or white numin. What's a numin? Karmic result, ripening karmic result. And here I have to make a point, okay? When they talk about the Buddha, I mean, numin seems to be like a samsaric thing. Like a karmic result which is experienced in samsara. They don't talk about the Buddha collecting the karma. He collects the two salts. He collects wisdom and merit. But they don't talk of this whole karma system in general. They don't talk much about the Buddha in terms of him collecting good karma, white karma or black karma. He's, if anything, he's doing sagmeti le. But you just don't see him referred to with the word numin. Numin would seem to be describing the samsaric karma. Well, it's a long debate, and I don't know. What would make you collect karma? I mean, I don't know. Well, what does he have? Sambha? Does he have that movement of the mind? According to Abhidharma, he must have.
Yeah.
One of the omnipresent mental functions. But you get into the higher schools, like we're studying the Rangyupa on Friday night. And they say it has to be motivated by a bad thought. That's Sambha, but it's Sambha motivated by a bad thought. So, that's a trick. We'll talk about it a little bit more. So, Sagmekile. And you're going to read in your reading about how to bring all of these karmas to an end, white and black. It talks about bringing white karma to an end. Bringing black karma to that. When I studied that and when I translated it, I didn't quite catch it. I didn't see why you'd want to bring white karma to an end. I thought maybe it had to do with something like seeing your karma as self-existent and stopping that tendency to see it as self-existent. And then I read a passage recently in a scripture which says, what it means when it says to bring white karma to an end, it means to purify it. By seeing itself. So that's pretty
close.
You purify the desire for it. The impure desire for it.
New white karma to bring the bad result.
Yeah. There may be some desire to do that which is still related to these three realms. And there's supposedly the last level of the last realm, it's very hard to get over the desire to still want to be there. You still think there might be something worthwhile there. And there's a long story in your reading. You have to go through, Bhavi Dharma say that the path of seeing and the path, the beginning of the path of meditation, habituation, only takes 16 seconds. And the whole thing happens. And they say they said that you would have to go on, that those 16 seconds or whatever remove the desire to take a birth anywhere in any of the realms. I mean, it's some kind of subtle thing where you wouldn't want, you recognize the fault of even a pleasant experience in the universe. So, and that's what they mean when they say to end even your white comet. You lose a desire to do anything that would even give you a good result in this life. What would it be in the Ram Rim? There's three levels in Ram Rim. It's called the small, lesser person, medium person, and greater person. And the lesser person wants to keep himself there. He wants to stay out of the three lower rooms. He doesn't want to be a hell being animal. And then the medium person?
Yeah,
he wants to put his rear end out of the okay. And then the highest person, he wants to get himself and everyone else out at the same time. So I guess you could say that in the Abhidhamma system, when you get to the point of the medium person, you've finished your white and black karma. You're not interested anymore in collecting a karma that's going to give you a nice result in some sense.
It seems to me that this is a cultural in the sense that, I mean, if you know the difference between samsara and liberation, why would it, if you know it, not if you just have heard of it, but if you know it, you believe it, why would anybody want to, fool around, flirt with finding some interesting thing in samsara anymore?
It's hard to recognize the difference, you know? It's hard to recognize that it's very hard to recognize yourself. It's very hard for any of us to recognize yourself.
But I mean, the Western problem is the other way around. They think that there's nothing but that. I mean, so having, thinking there's nothing but that, some good form of it is one thing. But to know that there's a beyond that,
by the way, it's not, I often say renunciation and removing desire for this life, it's not beyond us, it's just intelligent. It's just the normal recognition of a thinking person by the time he's 30 or 35, if you're lucky at 25. That just, you see that it's not going to work. Nothing works here. I often say I enjoy pleasure, and I've always enjoyed pleasure. I just wanted to get better ones, And I think you just recognize at some point that these pleasures don't. It's not that they're not pleasant. They have a pleasant quality about them, but they don't last. And they always change into something bad. So they're not. It's just a matter of recognizing that, and then you don't want them anymore. I mean, it's just a natural thinking person's desire to get out of pleasures which go sour. And that's all. I don't think it takes a genius to. If you look at it that way, I think you can get renunciation pretty easily. But it's, during the day, the reason you did most of your actions today, if you're like me, is that you hoped for some temporary pleasant result. That's why we get up, that's why we go to work, that's why we come home, that's basically why we move it all. So, you just have to at some point. It's not like you have to give up something nice. It's not nice. It's not like you're losing anything. It's hard though. It's hard to recognize it. Okay, so that's Sangme Kile. It mainly purifies black karma. That's how it's described, as purifying black karma. But then I started to talk about how it could also... I wasn't meaning... It is true that there's a relation to that in white karma, and it's in your reading. I didn't want you to get to the reading and think to yourself, Abhidhamma says I shouldn't do good deeds anymore. Or that somehow some kind of attachment is done. It's not like that. Okay. You don't want to get rid of the white karma until you see that it's still causing suffering.
Can you give us an example?
Well, let's say that you you really could get to a point where you realize correctly that you could design your future life. You know, theoretically, people in the study Lama Raymond study karma carefully and figure out how to design their future life. You know, they want to be rich, they want to be healthy, they want to be handsome, you know. And you can undertake deeds to step that up. And Pavonga says, when most people make a prayer to be born into a Buddhist paradise, they're normally mistaking the desire for some kind of happiness and samsara. Yeah. What their real intention is some kind of selfish desire, and they get what they ask for each other. You know, some kind of pleasure in this life, which just ends. So, there's two ways to get, according to Abhidharma, it's a very useful idea. According to Abhidharma, how to remove your desire. How to remove desire. You know, while we're on the subject of desire for this life, which really, really motivates us all day long. It's not until you get old and you kind of give up. You meet people, you get to a certain age and they give up on this life. There's a very distinct, you know, point at which they kind of give up. Bush kind of did that, I saw him on TV the other night. Kind of gave up on his political life. I mean, he doesn't think he's going to be coming back, or Reagan, or people like that. He kind of gave up on it. He said, well, that's over now. There's two ways, according to the Abhidharma, on how to remove your desire for this stuff. One is called Jitembe Lam. Say Jitembe.
Jitembe.
Lam.
Jitembe.
Jitembe.
Lam.
You know Jitembe, I think. You had it, no? His name is Purchakadeva. Already, yeah, the world. Okay. Jitembe Lam means what? Path. Jitembe Lam means the world is past. The world is past. This is a very, very interesting concept. This is where you get into deep states of meditation. And you move up from the desire realm into the beach of the four levels of the form realm, and then you move through each of the levels of the formless realm. So your meditation gets more and more and more subtle.
What do you mean?
What do I mean with form realm? You know, there's a causal form realm and there's a resulting form realm. You've got to know the difference. There's a form realm you can go to right now, and then there's a form realm you can be born in. And that's a big difference, and it's very confusing. It's really confusing. And some Mongolian Lama explained it to me many years ago. And the point is that you can do meditation now in this life, where your body stays in the desire realm, and you're in meditation posture. But your mind starts moving up to the form realm and the formless realm level. They are very much deeper levels of meditation. You go up slowly to four levels of form realm, and then you go up to four levels of form realm. And your mind gets very more and more and more and more subtle. Your meditation gets more and more subtle. Based on which one of those realms you've practiced in mostly, you take a birth in that realm. You see what I mean? So the meditation is a causal form realm. You're visiting the form realm with your mind. And then as a result of that, you're born into that level of the form of
meditation. You have to do that on your way to the perception of the voidness as well.
To see emptiness directly, you must be in Sambendamo Nyendo Nichome. The special level inside the preliminary level, inside the first level of the form. And it's not like you have to look for that place. You'll get there. If you meditate like more than 45 minutes a day, your mind eventually reaches that point quite comfortably. If you can do that, your mind is at that point. What's happened basically, what's happened, do you think, to your attraction to the objects of the desire realm, which are mostly sense objects, by the time you reach the form?
Well,
I mean, when you're in deep meditation, you feel like ice cream.
Once you get to deep meditation, you don't run away.
No, they don't. Because you can't get to the form realm, the first level of the form realm, in your meditation without giving up the attraction to the body. So it doesn't mean you can never eat ice cream again, I hope. But it means when you reach that level, you don't have any attraction anymore. You cannot see anything attractive. You're not hearing, you're not tasting. Your mind is withdrawn from this object of the senses. And that's called Shiraki number 10. Shiraki number 10 in this school means you're moving from a less subtle level to a more subtle level. And that you keep doing that. You know, you get used to the first level of the form realm, and you get a taste of the second level, and the first level starts to look bad. So you move up to the second level, then you get a taste of the third level, and then the second level doesn't look so... It looks very rough and it doesn't seem as deep, so then you try to move up into the third level. And doing that, you slowly give up all the levels. You know, you keep getting tired of the level that you're in and moving up to the next level. It's like pay at work, you know. And I first went to work and gave me $7 an hour. Very happy. It was great. You know, when I got 8 and I thought 7 looked bad. And I got 9 and I thought 8 looked bad. And then I got 100,000 a year and then 60,000 looked bad. You know, and like that. You know what I mean? It's like you move up through these levels. It's the same thing. That's the world it has. That's how to give up desire. Is it permanent? Is it desirable? No. And it's very common for Westerners to mistake that for some kind of losing desire. They think because they don't have desire to eat so much anymore, or they gave up desire for going to movies, or something like that. They think they are making spiritual progress. It's very dangerous, because you don't give up the desires. You move beyond them until such time as your mind slips back down. But it's not a permanent method. It doesn't work permanently. And you'll see that if you go into retreat, you stay there a month, you come out with some kind of glow. And for a while, you don't feel like eating, you don't feel like picking out anymore, you don't feel like going to movies anymore. You can, in the morning, you can study real well and meditate. And then slowly you come back into reality, and you end up the same as you were before. That's Shiraki number 2. It's called the worldly path. It's in the other dhamma. It doesn't stay.
Does it require subsequently more and more meditation to continue to advance up the realms? Is it just like an hour, hours, or 4 hours?
No, I think if you made it your goal, you could do it with an hour or two a day.
And when you say it doesn't work in the end, does that mean you never ultimately attain anything except higher desire?
Yeah, it doesn't get you out of samsara.
And what's your focus when you're doing the meditation?
You mistake the increasing subtlety of your mental state for some kind of liberation.
But you see, you would still be doing a single point of concentration, for example.
Yeah, by the time you reach the third and fourth, I mean, you're always concentrating. When you sleep, you go into meditation. Your sleep is meditation. And like that. But it's not, it doesn't, you and I know it doesn't remove your place. It doesn't remove your place. It's kind of a high. It's kind of getting more and more, your mind is more and more subtle. And it's attractive, and it's nice. And in a way, you give up the objects of the senses, because now you're attached to the objects of your pleasant meditation. And it gets more and more subtle, ultimately, it cannot remove your bad thoughts. Only one thing can remove your bad thoughts.
Only what?
Only one thing can remove your bad thoughts. Only one state of mind is in total contradiction to your bad thoughts. Only one state of mind is such that when I focus on you, If I think of that state of mind, it's impossible for me to have a bad thought. And that's understanding of that.
And that wouldn't happen in this kind of meditation?
And that's Jikken Nendepilam. That's number 2. Jikken Nendepilam means the path which is beyond the world. Nendepa means beyond. You could call it, there's a fancy word in the philosophy. Transcendental. You can say transcend the world. Okay, Nendepa is sort of, it's the path which transcends the world. And that's where you don't give up the desire realm or the form realm just because you're moving up into more subtle levels of meditation. But you give it up because you understand it's not. you're able to remove your desire for an object because you understand it.
But I mean, in order to get to that level,
you must have good motives.
No, but I'm saying is that
are they contradictory?
Thing of subtle, more subtle, more subtle. You're not going to get to.
No, not necessarily at all. Not necessarily at all. There are non-Buddhists who have reached the highest levels of that, stayed there for thousands of years, and no benefit.
So it's really the goal that you have in mind when you start to meditate?
Well, there is a level, especially in the first level of the former, where your mind is bright, sharp, clear, focused, powerful, you know, telescope. Now what you use it for is a different matter. Some people use it for black magic, thing, you know. That's just a tool. A non-Buddhist can use this one.
And that's the second one is Buddhist.
It has to be Buddhist. A Buddhist can use this by mistake or by not knowing enough, or it's very common to be attracted to that. But those people always end up dying, of course. It didn't work.
So Michael, there's this point when you get to the first level of the formless realm where you have this window of seeing emptiness directly.
Well, you have the tool.
Right.
Now if you have the other knowledge to focus it in the right direction, yeah.
So if someone's doing calm abiding meditation and they, you know, they bypass this and keep concentrating on the image of the Buddha or whatever, they miss the opportunity.
In a way.
So how do you know when to focus on emptiness?
As soon as you're capable, the reason to meditate on a Buddha image mainly, it's so virtuous that you can attain a deeper state of consciousness that you need to perceive emptiness.
Is the idea that you have to attain like the ninth level of calm abiding and calm abiding before shifting over to emptiness?
There's a thing called
alternating.
Alternating. Basically, to see emptiness directly, you have to have it.
Why
do
you talk about emptiness?
So, well, I'm so serious. I start off with emptiness. I want to make sure you understand. So, jiten le de belong. If you want to really remove desire, you need that one. And when they say, why did this all come up? Because the jiten le de belong refer to the different stages within which path. Which are the five paths that you can. Which are the five paths of beyond the world? But which are the five paths that you're moving from? Path of seeing. And then the path of capitulation. Because that's where you start. That's why you're a stream enter. You're on your way out. So this one relates mostly to that. And this Sangmenki Lay, this pure karma of the Abhidhamma school, refers to that also. They're all referring to understanding the selflessness, which is the only way remove your desire, and even your desire to collect good karma to have a good result in this life. We don't even have that. I mean, none of us goes home and says, I'll be nice to my husband or wife because if I do, I'll, in my next life, you know, they'll be loyal to me. I mean, we haven't even reached that. He's talking about how to remove that. You know, we haven't got that far. They both require deep meditation. They both require at least the first level of the former. This one is a process by which you are getting attached to, really, the increasing subtlety of your own meditation. And you mistake that lack of desire that you achieve for a real lack of desire, for the permanent lack of desire. You think you've gone beyond desire for this realm just because now you're attached to the higher sort of meditation, deeper sort of meditation. In other words, you're attached to the feeling of the meditation and not the purpose of the meditation. You start mistaking the means for the goal, something like that.
Could you go over causal and resultant in the
form, right? Yeah. In the form, I just wanted to say that how do you get to the former? How do you get born in the former? You get, in this life, you spend a lot of your time meditating on one of those former. in one of those states of deep meditation. And then because of that, you're born in that realm.
Isn't this one of the examples that's used about meditating when people believe that you should just meditate on nothingness, you know, that you should blank your mind out. You know, I know some people who both they knew about Dharma, maybe Zen or something, that they're saying you just, the object is to sit there and blank your mind out and think about nothingness. This could be a result of that.
There's a level of performance realm called Qiyangmei. And Qiyangmei means nothing at all. And it's where your mind is not focused on anything at all. And that's a rebirth that you take because you did in this life of meditation on trying to just empty your mind. And that's a samsaric rebirth. It doesn't have any benefit. And there was a great debate. I mean, there was a great debate in Tibet. There's still records of it between a Pashang and Samar Sila. And that viewpoint was eventually, you know, the idea that you should just try to empty your mind was eventually thereafter lead to that. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't calm your mind down. The purpose of breathing meditation, which first appears in the Abhidharma, and you can study it someday, the purpose of that practice, which is so popular in the Hinayana countries as a kingdom meditation, is that you want to put your mind into a neutral state, so that then you can focus in on a virtual state. And that, putting your mind into a neutral state, is the function of breathing meditation. And to reach that neutral state is great. That is a worthy goal. That's not the same as trying to think about nothing.
I'm really not clear about, and it feels really important to me, the idea of alternating between single point concentration and analytical meditation on emptiness. How you know when to switch. I thought the idea with calm abiding was that you stay with it until you attain calm abiding, not that you're switching back and forth while you're doing calm abiding.
It's not part of Abhidharma teaching. Well, there is a thing called Felgo, but it's in the sixth chapter.
Can you just say, for the sake of understanding how the meditation works?
Well, I would say that you're trying to move up your ability to concentrate, and then you're trying to move up the object to which you concentrate on. And then sometimes you concentrate on understanding the emptiness more. And then sometimes you concentrate on moving your concentration to a deeper level. And then you alternate between those. But when you perceive emptiness, there's no question of alternating. They're both happening at the same time.
I thought that was the biggest enemy in calm abiding, was changing your object. Switching.
That's a long story. But yeah, it would be.
So what do you do?
No, you can concentrate on once you get tired.
Yeah. I understand that it would not be desirable to be born out of the human realm because all those guys out there keep falling off.
Yeah.
Would it be better to take, thousands and thousands of hours to study beautiful to be born in?
Well, but if you don't meditate, this won't help you at all. And if you don't apply it to your life, it's definitely not helping at all. You'll think you know more, and you're going to be a worse person. And that's even worse than if you never study. You know, if you don't actively apply this, if you haven't changed a lot in the last 6 months, and then you've collected more knowledge, that's a very dangerous situation to be in. I don't envy that. You know, it's very dangerous to think you know more and not have changed your personal life at all. It's just you're ruining yourself. You know, I'm worried about it. With myself, too. You're going to be doing that. No, ultimately, you're going to have to meditate a couple hours a day, too. You must. You know, you must. Otherwise, you cannot move between paths except in a deep state of meditation. You cannot progress as far as realization unless you're in a deep state of meditation. If you don't study deeply, you'll never know what to do when you get there. But they both have to come together. And then you've got to be virtuous, too. Tsongkhapa, I'm writing, studying his life story, all his biographies, Sikha biographies, you should read already. But he's spending half his life praying for wisdom. A lot of his activity was spent in caves, just praying to understand more. It's strange how many hours he spent doing that.
What do you pray to? There's no omniscient God that's going to give it to you.
I think it's the virtue of asking them to inspire you.
Even though they can.
Well, when you ask like them, the virtue of asking brings this place. Seriously. That's how it is, Bob. It does work. It really does work. Yeah.
You talk about your meditation being more formal, but if you haven't gotten anywhere near the answer directly, but you do feel more subtle than there was before, are you still in this world?
Oh, yeah.
Also, there's lots of subtle to the answer.
Oh, a lot, yeah. When you get the squirm around, you'll know it.
It's actually, you get some physical,
you get some physical sensations. Rising into the
world. So you can say the squirm around really long and get different
stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What did you say about the sensation?
There's some sensation of rising. When you come out, there's some sensation of coming out.
It doesn't have to be 2 seconds.
Michael, in the last class, you said that Arya is no longer her left karma.
Yeah.
Bad karma. And you never explained that. So that now that we're in karma, can we talk about it?
Why they don't collect bad karma?
Yeah.
They don't. I'll tell you in a second.
I mean that they're not collecting it as long as they're receiving it directly, but when they come out of meditation.
Hang on a second, I'll say it. I'll answer your question very briefly, okay? You missed the last two classes. The answer is in those classes. We try to get the notes from the last class, because we went through 6 steps in a process by which a lack of understanding emptiness forces you to that process. And so, ergo, if you could understand emptiness, you wouldn't collect karma. You have to read that. It's involved with misperception. But to put it very simply, if I look at the person, I'm trying to think of today, someone bothered me today.
Only
within the last 10 minutes. I was on the plane. But I was looking at the person, I was thinking, I was looking at the person and I was thinking, you know, I was starting to get angry, but then when I looked at the office and I said, you see, if you understand it's emptiness, then all you have to remember is that it's empty. Because that makes you think, well, what does empty mean? Well, empty means it's a blank, that person is a blank screen, and I'm seeing this person as bad because of my own karma. Now, what shall I do? That's the whole thought process. What shall I do? And you just grin and bear it. That's
about all you can do. I mean, I can see where that modifies the way you act, physically act. But you have said a number of times over the past 6 months that, for example, you know, just because you understand a beautiful girl walking across the street is empty doesn't
help
you get rid of your desire.
It does. Absolutely. I said all those other theories of emptiness that people presented to me that didn't satisfy me for many years, didn't help. And I really tried to use them, you know. Tried to see this pretty girl as the Carla Adams, you know. Or Shanti Davis as, you know.
Looking at
the scale. No, like that, or see her poop and all that, or realize that you're just attracted to the clothes and the hair and the jewelry and the perfume. And not to the girl. Well, that, to me, doesn't help me much, you know. No, if I understand the emptiness of the person, and I understand that if I desire anything, if I do anything to the point of an improper desire, I will not, I'll never meet such a person again. that I can buy, you know, and I'll be good.
I can see how you'd understand your fitness, you'd be able to modify your physical action.
Your response.
And you'd be able to make some change in your emotional response.
Yeah.
But absolutely.
It's thinking that... No, you can't... Well, we did the whole last 2 classes on it. Get some tips. You cannot entertain the thought of desire or hatred if you understand that object emptiness. You cannot entertain it. It will not stay in the same mind.
Out of meditation.
Yeah, the point is...
No, I'm talking out of meditation. I'm talking when someone's in a car next to you and punching you in the head.
But after achieving Tonglen, you come back out of the meditation. And to Ariel's point, those people still see things that way.
Oh, you still see it as something.
They have an intellectual understanding, but they're actually seeing it. That's
the intellectual understanding does wonders to prevent you from collecting. I'm talking about intellectual understanding. I'm not talking about a direct perception of that person's identity. Of course. You know, you couldn't look at a pretty girl and understand her and do anything more than understand her emptiness intellectually. You couldn't perceive her through the perception of deep direct perception. Leave it. We'll never finish on time. Okay. Four parts of a karma. Okay. Of a lekilam. Sometimes called a lelam. You know it by now. What's a lelam? Karmic path of karma. Sometimes they call it a path of action. Sometimes it's confusing called both. Okay, lekilam. There are 10 lekilams. The 10 non-virtues are lekilam. Those are karmic paths. Later we'll get into the distinction between karma and a karmic path. But a karmic path is going to have these elements to it. What is a she? She means the object involved. And these are all important concepts, and I've put them into your reading from the Lamrim Chimel, from Tetsun Kampa, because he explained it so well. I kind of regret we just didn't go through the Lamrim Chimel. I want you to see some Abhidharma. I hope you live long enough to study the other one. She. So she is the... What do you think the object is involved is for the first number? Killing. What's the object involved?
Person.
A living being. That's all. The sheep. The object involved for the act for the Lekhi Lama of killing is a living being.
Yeah. I have a question about object and its relation to that. What is the object? Do they mean the actual thing out there, or do they mean the
The
object is
the
mind.
Oh. The problem is that there's not enough words in English for all the Sanskrit together. We're using object to mean thing. We're using object to mean as opposed to subject. See what I mean?
But I think isn't the object is the mind.
We're using it here to mean the stuff involved. When you talk about karmic path, you talk about the stuff involved. Why? Well, what's the sheep or stealer? It's not the person you're stealing from. It's something which is owned by another person. You see what I mean? So that's a tough word to translate. The Tibetan means basis. And some people translate it as basis, but I don't know, it doesn't quite hit me. What is the basis? Anyway, what would it be for wrong view? The laws of karma. The stuff involved that you're going to do the bad deed about is a lot of karma. You're going to deny it. What about for a covenant? Yeah, other people's good quality, other people's wealth, and other, you know, their good personal qualities, their intelligence, stuff like that. Okay. So that's a sheep. Sampa means the thinking. Not thinking involved. Mainly intention. But we're gonna talk more about that one shortly. Mainly intention.
Is it motivation?
You can call it motivation also, but we're gonna get deeper into that. We're gonna discuss number two later on. Jorwa is to undertake the undertaking of the deed. That's where, for example, a lot of people say preparation, but it's not really preparation. It does mean preparation in some cases. But this is where you actually take a knife and go after the person. This is the deed. This is your undertaking the deed. Doing the deed, but you need partuk. It has to be separate. Partuk means the finalization of the deed. Completion of the deed. When is the deed complete in the first number? When he died. could either be at the time that you stabbed him, or it could be as a result of his wound 6 months later. So you could have a Jorwa without a Tartuk. You could go on for 6 months having undertaken the deed to kill the person, but he didn't. He was in the hospital and then finally died 6 months later. You didn't collect the Tartuk until 6 months later.
Wouldn't it be something you collected just from the act of stabbing him?
We'll talk about it. The fact that comes up next in the Abhinama. But these are the things to... These are the things that really make the karma a karma. And when you've got these four complete, it's a great karma. And you can see how one could be incomplete. Like, you could jorwa a person. You could attempted murder, right? That attempted murder means the guy didn't manage the tartuk. Right? Sampa means, for example, he wanted to kill somebody. The person was, I told you about the guy, you see a lump in the bed and you shoot it with a machine gun. The guy died of a heart attack a half hour earlier already. There's no joy on that. I mean, there's no sampa in the sense of recognition of what he is. And we'll get into that. They talk about it like that sometimes. They say, well, I'm glad I did that. You know, there's sometimes they describe it, and in the Abhidharma it's called Juk, and it's a different, it's not called Tartuk in the Abhidharma. It's the finalization means, oh, I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I did a good job. But that's not how Tsongkhapa in this section explains it. By the way, these four come from Asanga, ultimately. They come from Maitreya. And you're going to see how. It's in your reading. That's where these four basically come from.
Michael, these refer also to good karma?
Absolutely. But what the main point is, and you can see it, when you have all four there, it's powerful. Parents have... the reason they are Shinji Kyeparsen, why they're extraordinary objects, is on the basis of the benefit they have given you. The extreme dedication of their early part of your life, at least, that they, if they had loved you for more than a day or so, you'd be just dead, period. That dedication of a good parent or a lousy parent or any parent, and the process of being pregnant and 9 months of suffering and all that, that's a special bond. And they talk about it, if you kill if there's two women, one gave her egg for you, and one gestated you, and you shoot them both, which one was the killing your mother? And there's a big debate about it, because the woman who gestated you actually gave more of herself to benefit you. There's a big debate about it in the Abhidhamma. Okay, so that's Dushya.
So they had artificial. Apparently
they had something like that, because they discuss it. They discuss, you know, what if one woman's egg is put in another woman, and then which one is the real mother? It's in this... Who said what the consciousness was? Say Nyomo?
Nyomo.
Nyomo or Duksum? What's Duksum? Nyomo means bad thought. Duksum means what? Three poisons, which are liking, disliking, and ignorance. Liking, disliking, and ignorance. You will read in your reading, certain of the bad deeds can have all three motivate them. Certain of the bad deeds can only have one. And like that. See, normally, harsh words, for example, are what?
Dislike.
Because of dislike. They're almost always, I guess they're always dislike. Sexual misconduct, adultery, could be out of desire for the other person or out of a wish to harm their spouse. So it could be out of desire or...
It is New York City. Harsh words are all around the place. It has nothing to do with dislike. It's just...
No, if you're in a milieu,
free floating.
No, if in your milieu, it's it's normal to say, "Oh, you crap hen," or, you know. I mean, in my college dormitory, we all had this nickname. You know, and it was very loving.
Yeah, but it's not said
it's very, no, that's not harsh words.
No,
it's harsh words to say something sweet when you want a person to go to hell, and you know that they'll take it that way. But that's a harsh word. Okay. Third one is, what is the third one? Oh, yeah. Bad thought. So is it disliking or liking or ignorance, which is, and there's a different nyomon going into it and a different nyomon coming out of it, and you'll see that in your
mind.
Yeah, it's the Tibetan word for klesha.
Well, and is it your klesha as well? I mean, you haven't used the term klesha.
I don't use the word klesha much. Bad thought. I like bad thought. The definition of a nyoma, we had it in the Friday night class, very beautiful. It's a semi-mishiwa chepa, that thought which disturbs the tranquility of the mind. And Westerners have a hard time translating mental affliction, mental delusion. I don't like delusion. It implies a misperception. They're based on a misperception, but they are not misperceptions, necessarily. Kunlong, say Kunlong. Kunlong is the motivation or the intention. And this is where you get into, like, manslaughter. What's manslaughter? And this is where you hit somebody with a car and you didn't drive down the street thinking, I'd like to hit the first person who jumps out on their car. And therefore, Kunlong is not there. You didn't get into your car hoping to kill somebody that day. And in the courts and the karma are pretty much reflect each other. You know, common sense tells you that person is not as guilty as someone who gets into his car and thinks, I'm going to hit the first pedestrian I can see. So if any or one of these are not present, what's the nyomong like if you're trying to benefit? Like euthanasia, the nyomong is very tricky. The kunlong is very tricky. Kunlong is virtuous. You get a virtue from the motivation. And then the jowa is very mistaken. Very bad. I like that. Take a break. Please come back in 10 minutes and I can finish. If you do. Okay. We're doing okay. We have one more question to do.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
It goes back to what I was asking before about the calm abiding meditation, mm-hmm. same appointed versus, you know, the alternating analytical. You know, I have a friend who has been trying to attain calm abiding meditation for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think her experience has been that she continues to experience more and more subtle levels of pleasure. And
yeah.
And so I think I think the training she has received has been strictly single point of concentration, nothing else, not alternating that. It's been the calm abiding training.
Yeah. On what?
Well, the first time she tried it, she did it on her breath. Then she tried it again, using the Buddha image. And she's doing it again. This is like her like third and a half year. So, I sent her the tapes from the other class that we did. She's very interested in them. And I think it would be really important for her to understand what the subtle aspect of that balance is, or at what point to shift, you know, what point to start to alternate, or to be aware of getting into that trap of passing up the opportunity to concentrate on emptiness when it's appropriate. In calm abiding meditation. But when you talk calm abiding, you said the biggest enemy to calm abiding is changing your object.
Well, there's some tricks in on that. You know, the union of the two.
In calm abiding?
Yeah.
What did you say about the union of the two in calm abiding?
Well, normally they're calm. You know, the union of the two is, you know what I mean?
in terms of the technique of doing the common binding meditation, the wisdom of the analytical meditation on emptiness and the single pointed concentration on the Buddha image.
No, it's not like that. It's really not like that.
So what is it like?
It's not like you... I mean, it's not like you concentrate on a Buddha image and try to get shine on that, and then skip over to emptiness and try to use it on emptiness or something. It's not like that.
See, the way it was explained...
No, it's not like that.
I mean, see, the way it was... She told me Genlin Rinpoche explained it to her is just that it's so hard to do some calm body meditation on emptiness. So
you should
it's much better to do a calm body meditation on virtue sanjay, Buddha image. And after you attain calm body on a Buddha image, then you switch over to the emptiness
that's
meditation.
Correct.
But what you're saying though is...
But it's not that you would... that's just to get the microscope up to power.
But what I was understanding you were saying was is when you get far along in your calm body meditation, you know, this first level of formless realm, you have this opportunity...
If you did not use the Buddha image.
What if you were using
to
the
get Buddha? There, you need that.
That's what I'm saying. If you continue
you need
to use
some virtuous, plain, easy object.
My point is if you continue to use the Buddha image, can you still skip over the opportunity to be concentrating on emptiness?
Oh yeah, you
right
could.
Time?
Yeah, it's theoretically possible.
Is it not likely, or what's the deal? You know? I mean,
yeah,
you
it
Buddha
would
image,
be likely if you weren't
image.
Studying at the same time. If you weren't exposed,
if you didn't know what to look for and when to switch, and that
if you weren't exposed to the proofs for emptiness, then you wouldn't it wouldn't happen.
What wouldn't happen?
You could reach that stage in a way that non-Buddhists reach it in
would,
India a lot.
You wouldn't know what to look for,
and you wouldn't. You'd just stay there, and you might go farther along in those meditations, and take the meditation as being your goal.
So you mean the first level of the formless?
Yeah.
That's when you're saying you have to make a switch.
No, I didn't mean that. I mean you should develop the ability to get to there.
Yeah.
And then you should keep studying emptiness. And once you develop the ability to get there...
But you don't want to get above that before you shifted your object.
I don't think you could get above that. Yeah, you couldn't get above that. Yeah, you could go above that. You could get hung up in it.
So the idea is to be able to identify when you get to the first level of the form realm so that you know you're there, so you know that it's time to shift to emptiness. And when you get to the first level of the form realm in your calm body meditation, you say, okay, I'm here, now I need to shift to emptiness.
I don't think it would happen in one session like that.
Well, I mean,
over a period of months, you would develop the ability to be there, and you would know it. And then you start studying emptiness. You start studying the scriptures about it. And then every time you go into that meditation, you start
doing
emptiness meditation. But I think that the time, at the moment that it's triggered, that you go into the path of seeing, it's not. There's a lot more going on in the few weeks before that than in the moments before that. You know what I mean? The weeks before that, you are exposed to certain arguments for emptiness, and you start to think about that, and you work on your subconsciously.
You mean in a supervised course of study?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
In terms of doing calm body meditation, does the first level of the form realm, does that come after attaining calm abiding or before? Oh, so you still have to attain calm abiding before you can get to the first level. Oh, I thought it was before you attain calm abiding. Oh, I see. Okay, I got you. So then this idea of do as a calm abiding practice, switching back and forth, you wouldn't switch back and forth between emptiness. That was my confusion.
Yeah, no, you develop the ability to do it, and then you...
After you attain calm abiding, then you switch. Okay.
And then maybe a week later you start working on it. But you're actually doing both at the same time.
Both what?
You're building up your shine,
yeah,
shamatha, yeah, and you're studying emptiness during the day. You know, you can't meditate all day long.
During the calm body practice.
No, I mean, you practice meditating on different objects. I mean, whatever it happens to be you're using.
Yeah.
And then you reach a stage of shini,
right,
shamatha.
After you attain that stage, you're
saying. And then after you take, well, while it's not like you stop and then you go back and meditate. I mean, during that time, theoretically, on your during your breaks, you've been reading emptiness.
I thought you said during shini practice you're not supposed to do anything, including read.
If it's a retreat, yeah.
That's what I'm talking about, a retreat.
Yeah, if it's
a pure
retreat,
retreat.
Yeah, you can't. You shouldn't do. Ideally, you shouldn't read any book.
I'm thinking in the context of my friend who's doing this.
Yeah, ideally you wouldn't read any books. Except, personally, I found it when I got very bad. Then a book brought me down. And it was useful. I think in meditation, generally you're not supposed to read anything. If you do read anything, it can only be long-read books. But now you're supposed to read specialized books. Definitely not magazines.
Definitely not magazines.
They're really bad in a retreat. They're really destructive.
Or novels, or fiction.
Yeah. Very bad. They're very bad for your company.
Even specialized Dharma books aren't good, huh?
Well, if you have to, but, you know, not like a technical discussion of, you know. Well, that's. I mean, you're not supposed to sit down and study Vinaya rules. You know what I mean? Should be something I want to do. But it can be a distraction. It's better not to see anybody at all. Better not to look outside at all. You have your windows closed up. Better not to see the people who see you. Absolutely better not to speak a word. You know, the Abhidharma has some discussions of morality, you know, about moral conundrums. Yeah. And one of them is, I just thought it was important, so I took it in there. It's not, you know, they discuss, what about a war? If you're in a war, there's a war effort. I think we talked about it before. And you're not on the front line, but you're supporting the war effort. And if someone on the front lines kills somebody, do you collect the karma of killing? You know, this has big repercussions. This one question, to me, has big implications. You know, because then this whole question of, if I work for Andine International and the company as a company screws up somebody and I, if I'm contributing, you know, am I responsible? Do I collect the karma?
It's like how many people voted for Picasso?
But
well, I mean, anybody who's got capital punishment as part of their class.
Oh, that's true. That's
can't
actually
go
correct.
For.
So anyway, the conclusion of the Abhidharma, I leave it to you to read. You know, it's not my conclusion. I thought it was important to you, ethically speaking. But it says he's just as liable as the person who pulled the trigger. And he collects the karma. You understand? That you can read it, it's not me.
It doesn't
mean that Well, one thing you should know, one principle of this is that for either you to do it yourself or to appoint someone else to do it, it's totally the same karma. If you hire someone to go have adultery because you're not handsome enough to hurt the other guy, you know, if the other guy's wife would be attracted to you, she'd hurt her husband, it's exactly the same karma as if you did it. Says Rangi and Rangi Kut. Me, you are someone that you put up to do it. The argument I've heard about eating meat, and I don't eat meat, is that when you go to the store, you're buying, you're not killing, you're buying meat. You don't say I'm going to food market to see you now.
But you're participating.
I've heard this argument. I believe there is a distinction between buying meat and going to the slaughterhouse and studying there.
Yeah, that's where they get all the Muslims.
But I have to say The Lotus Sutra says, don't eat pig meat, don't eat cow meat, don't eat fish meat, don't eat humans meat, yay meat. I don't know, I leave it to you. But it was not, and I don't want to go against the very high lamas who have said it's different. I have had other things to say about it. I just leave it like that. I don't know. I can't eat it. But I think you're very lucky if you can stop eating it. And I think moral things, you kind of have to, you know the rules, you know the principles. I think then you have to apply it to your best of your knowledge.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I don't know. You take your own. I don't know. You read the reading and see how it applies in your mind. You know, if it's with the intent to harm the other people, and if you're contributing like this, you have to change jobs.
It tends to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Well, that's a little bit less. The kulong, the motivation, the intention is not directly to harm other people. I think that's the distinction between mowing the lawn and killing roaches. I mean, if you mow the lawn, you're going to kill insects. But you didn't go out, you didn't say, I'm going to go out today and kill bugs. You said, I'm going to go out and mow the lawn. There is a distinction between them. But I'll tell you one thing, and I can't help but go back to it in my mind. I remember Tom saying, what should we do about the incompetent guy? It's been bothering me for a few days. You know, or should we fire him or not? I had to do this. Strictly speaking, the only thing that can give you, it's so obvious that we have missed it our whole lives. The only thing that can give you a good result, absolutely, positively, the only thing that can give you any kind of good result is a kindness. It's a good deed. There's nothing else possible that can give you a good result. Period. Nothing. It's impossible. It doesn't work that way.
If you just gave an example, if I get it right, what sounded like lying, when you said that harsh words would include speaking in a kind voice.
Oh, that's kind. That's not kind. That's not what I call kind. That's not kind at all.
Let me finish. But the point is, however, whatever your feelings are, you're not acting out in an angry fashion that will harm the other person, even though you haven't been able to get past
that.
Oh, no,
that's
bad
that's a mental bad need and not a verbal bad need. That's great. But I want to go back to this thing before we lose the sense of it.
What I'm saying is this.
It's very. I don't want to get to that level.
On.
Come up to a different level. I want to talk about a very deep level. Nothing in the world good can come from anything except a good deed. Impossible. There's no such thing. There's no way to manipulate your world and achieve anything good in your world except by doing a good deed. And if you happen to take some action and you get some goodness happening subsequent to that, it's just coincidence. It's just factors involved. But what I'm saying is that if anything good comes out of anything you ever do, it's because of something good you did before. It's nothing to do with the action of the moment. And you have to, if you lived your life like that, your life would be radically different. You would look like a fool or crazy or something. You would be kind to everyone. And as a result, half the time you'd be getting screwed. And it would look like a bad way of acting. It would look like an uncomfortable way of acting. It's not true. It's an illusion. That's all.
That's clear cut, but there are situations where you have to. You can't can't be kind to everyone. If you keep the incompetent person on, you're unkind to the boss, is losing money.
Well, I want to say this, though. And I regretted not saying it. If the company's losing money because of this person, and if you remove the person, and suddenly the company makes more money, it had nothing to do with removing or not removing the person.
So let's go out and hire all the incompetent people.
Wait a minute, Michael.
I'm just saying, I tell you, try it for a while. I mean, maybe something will happen. Whatever we did in the past didn't work.
Wait a minute, just listen. Is it kind or honest to keep a person in
a job? That's a different...
No, but that's an issue.
No, if you can do it with great... holy kindness, and if you are, it's absolutely a good deed. I never said that.
Okay, but I'm just.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay. Go ahead. Sorry, this is 5 to 9. Okay. But I just say that. I think it's worth. We will finish on time. But that's the whole guts of it. You have based your life so far on a perception of what worked and what didn't work, and it didn't work. Life so far was dysfunctional. And it doesn't work that way. It's not causation. It doesn't follow the laws of causation. Why? It's obvious because it doesn't work all the time. If you had really found the laws of causation, then the normal things you do at work to remove a bad guy and get more profit would work all the time, and they don't. But that's not really what's happening. That's all. Okay. Last question. What's the difference between a lay and a legi lam? I had it the other day. We were trying to decide whether to send the dogs for a flea bath. It would remove the flea. Apparently it would remove the flea. No connection. Absolutely no connection.
I'm sorry?
If the dogs experienced some result where they had no more fleas and they felt much better, it's got nothing to do with taking the flea bath. Nothing. Sorry. I collected a very bad deed, and the fact that suddenly they didn't have fleas had nothing to do with the flea bath. Think about it.
On a conventional level, it does.
So
talking about conventional versus ultimate.
Cleaning the gutter, because it's being cleaned, has nothing to do with our cleaning, right?
That's a goodness. I did an evil, and I must get an evil result. If there's any pleasure that anyone got out of my deed, it had no relation to my deed. I'm trying to say that. That's profound. That has profound implications for your life. It's probably what you're supposed to do to get out of samsara. I don't know. Okay, lay and legi lam. What's the difference between a karma and a karmic path? Okay, I used to wonder about it all the time. I saw a very nice quotation. And I'll read it to you. Namsam sok yigisam chöjön, which means, let's consider the three bad deeds of mine, which are what? Craving? Oh boy, what kind of Buddhist? You can't even get into that. Yeah, craving, ill will, and wrong view. Coveting, ill will, and wrong view. Okay. He said, let's consider those three. They are a path of karma. They are a path of action. Because they function to move the sempa. They motivate the sempa. They motivate the movement of the mind to move to its object. They are a path of action because they motivate the movement of the mind to shift to its object. Okay, take those three. They are a path of action. They are a path of karma because they motivate the movement of the mind to shift to a new object. Yeah, what I'm trying to say is that we said it in the Friday night class. Those three things by themselves. Well, I'm about to tell you. Are not karma.
They are not karma?
No, I'll take it back. They are karma.
They're the cause of karma. They're the source of karma.
The result of karma.
They're a path of karma.
Sorry, no, they are not karma. They are karma.
Yes.
They are the example. You got to think about it. They are the example of something which is a path of karma, but not karma. They are.
So you do it.
No. They're not karma.
The movement of the mind.
They motivate, they trigger the movement. And that's very difficult to understand. You have to cook it.
So are you saying the path of karma is what triggers the movement of the mind, essentially?
You can have a... Those three states of mind are not karma.
Right, I understand. But they are the thing which triggers the
movement
of the mind.
Yeah, they motivate the karma.
So you're saying the path of karma is what triggers the movement
of
the mind?
That's how he's defining it, yes. That's his proof for why they are a path of karma.
Because they cause the movement of the mind.
Yeah, because they motivate the movement of the mind. That's kind of interesting. Okay. He says the seven of body and speech.
The what?
The seven of body and speech. The three of body and the four of speech. The seven bad deeds. Are not only paths of action or paths of karma, but also what?
Karma.
Because they provide an opportunity for the movement of the mind to act itself out. The seven are both.
They include the thought.
Yes.
That motivates me.
I'm sorry, no. They are the thought thing to do. They're not the thinking itself. But because they provide an opportunity for the thought to act itself out, we call it the concept. No. Because it doesn't provide an opportunity for the movement of the mind to act itself out. You gotta cook it. The movement of the mind involved, the movement of the mind which is separate and distinct from them, which goes on with them, is the karma. It's not karma. And the movement of the mind which is going on together with it is karma. It itself is not karma. It is itself is not karma. It is a path of karma.
It sort of causes you to bad things.
It motivates karma.
But karma is movement of mind.
Yes.
So if you're in the midst of...
The movement of the mind is distinct from the anger, or distinct from the love, or distinct from the passion, or distinct from the ignorance, or distinct from the... Yeah, I'm trying to say that. You have two mental functions. Separate mental functions. Okay. By the way, this is a big argument about this. A lot of the Abhidhamma schools says it's not true. They say it is karma. There is a heavy argument about it. So obviously there would be, right? The last example, last thing. Can you give me a case of something that's karma but not a path of karma?
Can I just ask a quick question? You said there are two mental functions.
Yeah.
Which one is karma and which one is not karma?
The movement of the mind is the karma.
Right. And
the anger, the attachment, the coveting, the ill will, those are not karma.
Does the path of karma?
They are a path of karma. Well, I'll give it to you since it's fine. Anything which is karma but not a path of karma. Those movements of the mind themselves. Movement of the mind.
Any
moment. They say Semba, they seem to be, the text is not there, it seems to be referring to the ten. Semba's going on. And the ten are going on.
Oh. So they have passes
and
they're still
big. They are karma itself, they're not passive.
I don't understand the terminology in English.
The thing is that those ten things, those ten bad deeds are not a list of ten bad karmas. And Buddhism, no Buddhist text says they are. Lots of teachers will go around and tell you these are the ten bad karmas. Last three are not karmas.
Seven,
That's good. Well, we just had all the possibilities, right? We found something which is karma, but not a kind of karma, which is what? Movement of the mind itself. What's the path of karma but not karma? Those three, the last three. What's the path of karma and karma?
Yes,
bye. You need reading. You gotta think about it.
Is the idea that the mental functions that follow behind the movement of the mind don't count, isn't that just the movement of the mind? Is that the idea?
The moving of the mind, which is the shifting of the mind towards its object,
is only the primary mental function?
It's a separate mental function.
And the stuff that trails behind that doesn't count?
Trailing means happening at the same time, actually. Those are not karma.
So whatever follows the primary doesn't count as karma. It doesn't count as the movement of the mind. Is that understanding it correctly?
Well, what's cool is, basically that. We could have a huge debate about it, though, because we said virtuous by
association.
Being, yeah.
Sasi Bhagi Jusine Tasham Viravin Shinyande Yampadi Sange Shindu Mitte Uwagi Jogunanda Shimba
is the end of Class 7.